Coming up on this week's show, turn your Wii into a classic Mac.
Record videos on your Game Boy camera.
And we chat retro football games with Simon Reed.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every weekend with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, obviously, we're into December now. You might be thinking about retro gaming gifts for Christmas. One of their books you need to check out, I'm Too Young to Die, The Ultimate Guide to First-Person Shooters, a glorious 400-plus page book that is a love letter to the early years of the first-person shooter. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay, who offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards. And did you know that they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding? And they're big supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 355, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us for our weekly roundup of all the big happenings in the world of retro gaming and technology. And of course, bringing you a very special guest to give us their history and their time in the industry in the second half of the show as well. Now, of course, this is our first podcast in December. Anyone recording this podcast while they're looking over at the Christmas lights twinkling on the Christmas tree?
Not just yet. My missus did get them all down from the attic today. And I did come downstairs from doing some work today and she had bought, you know, like the big outdoor lights, but she'd bought the ones that like hang from like, like your drains, like your drain pipes across the top of your house. And I thought, oh my God, there's going to be like something like Christmas at the Cranks or National Lampoon with me falling off the roof, putting them up tomorrow.
So you're going to be up the ladder this weekend then?
Yep, I will be breaking my neck, no doubt.
Well, it is insane that we're now into December. That means there are 2 weeks to go until one of our favourite episodes of the year, the Retro Hour annual Christmas Super Quiz is coming up in a couple of weeks. The best of 2022 as well. All of that coming up over the next few weeks. And before we get into what's going to be happening on this week's show, just a quick reminder that we are now almost at the end of our Kickstarter for the Retro Hour book. And since last week's show, we have some pretty exciting news. We've only gone and done it.
We've gone and done it. Somebody crank out the champagne, get the party poppers going. Yeah, no,
we are. Let me slurp on my coffee in celebration.
Yeah, slurp on the coffee. I've got a Dr. Pepper. No, absolutely massively blown away. Sunday morning, I think we all woke up to us hitting our target goal of 25,000, which is just absolutely blown us away. You know, we had a few kind of nervous moments, especially before we actually launched it as well. Like, is this going to happen? As we said before, it's kind of now or never with, you know, the prices of everything going up. But what that does mean is the book is happening. We've got, at the point of recording this, about 10 days left now, so there's going to be 7 days left by the time this episode comes out. But what's really, really cool is because we have hit it, we are now able to announce our stretch goal and some more of the features that are going to be in the book, which are absolutely awesome, aren't they, Dan?
Yeah, so we just want to say a massive thank you to everyone who's made this a reality. The book is going to get printed. You will have it in your hand. I honestly can't wait to see what it looks like. And if you've seen any of the previews as well, you'll know that we've really put a lot of work into this. And like Joe said then, I mean, the aim is now that we've hit, you know, the minimum, we can actually make this happen. We want to aim a bit higher and obviously make the book even better as well. So we've announced this week that there are some stretch goals as well. So the aim is, if we can make 35,000 on Kickstarter, we're going to add in 4 brand new interviews with some more industry legends who we've never featured fully on the podcast before. Now, these are some pretty big names, and we've overcome things like language barriers and time zones and everything. Guess what? We couldn't actually physically get on the podcast, but have actually given us their time for an exclusive interview in the book. So I know the first one you're very excited about, Ravi.
Yeah, so I love these guests because the book kind of has, you know, we've got a lot of American focus in there. We've got a lot of UK and European focus as well. But this is a side that we've not really had on the podcast this much, which is quite hard because, you know, there's stuff like translation and we've kind of gone through that, and we've got some amazing guests coming up. So the first one is Motohiro Kawashima, and he's a basically a DJ and composer of the Streets of Rage soundtrack. So he co-composed it. He kind of went for Streets of Rage 2, 3, and 4. So 4 was the most recent version, and he's kind of updated that to a modern style. Also, Eye of the Beholder and Batman Returns. His style's wicked. The interview is telling us all about how they used to go to techno clubs and all this. I'm not going to ruin it, but there's some awesome info on that one.
Just one thing to say on that as well is, I mean, these soundtracks to these games are so incredible. They've actually been released standalone on vinyl in the past.
Oh, yeah. You know, Streets of Rage is one of the most like banging soundtracks that you can get. Yeah. It's like totally out of the club vibe. Then we've got Dylan Cuthbert, who's someone I've always wanted to get on the show. Yeah. He's the founder of Argonaut Games. And he's the kind of British guy that ended up getting taken over to Japan and becoming an integral part of Nintendo. And he's the main programmer behind the absolutely groundbreaking Star Fox and Star Fox 2. Then we've got an amazing pixel artist, one of the world's best, which is Henk Nyborg. Now, we've had Henk on the podcast before when he was chatting to Bitmap Bureau, but we didn't go into that much detail with him. And this is kind of an extended interview where we're going to look at some of his titles, you know, Lionheart, which was just wicked, Misadventures of Flink, and Shanty as well, which has recently got a lot of attention. And then finally, we've decided to pull an extra one out of the bag just to surprise you lot. And that's Andrew Braybrook, who is the creator of the classic Iridium 1, 2, Paradroid, Gridley's Day Out, and, you know, these amazing platformers like Fire and Ice as well. So there's such a range of guests coming out.
You know, you mentioned Fire and Ice as well, but to me, now we're in December, that is a staple Christmas game that I play
it's
every year,
Christmas-y, Fire and Ice, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so always want to get Andrew on the show, so we're really pleased that he's going to be featuring in the book as well. So they're exclusive interviews that you'll only read in the book if we hit that stretch goal, and that is up and running right now. So if you haven't backed the book, there is still a week left to do it. You've got to be quick, and you'll find all the details at theretrohour.com. Right, then, before we get into the news this week, we have got a brilliant guest to talk to on this week's podcast as well. I mean, obviously, footy fever is everywhere at the moment. Even me and Joe, who are not really into sports that much, you know, we're getting caught up a bit in the football fever with the World Cup being on, aren't we?
We are. I have just, as we record right now, and I feel really bad because Ravi is actually a football fan. The England game, the England versus Wales game is actually on as we record. And I have actually checked the score. It was only 4 minutes in then, so nothing
tell me.
Happened much. No, I won't tell you. I'm guessing you're going to watch it afterwards.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've actually found myself checking the score. But I believe that's because I get caught up in it. And as I've said on previous episodes, I now do work for a sports company. So it's good for me to walk into work tomorrow and actually be able to say something about the game.
Well, I mean, football games on computers and consoles, they've always been something that, you know, I love stuff like, you know, Sensible World of Soccer and Kickoff 2. I could play those games because they were good arcade experiences. And recently on the podcast, we've kind of been talking quite a bit, I think mainly in our Patreon section recently, haven't we, about these kind of new retro-inspired football games.
Yeah.
So we thought we'd get the creator of a couple of those games on, and also someone who's got a big history in making sports games. And kind of going back to the Amiga days as well, you know, used to be a programmer in Amos, used to do some adventure games back then. And this is the founder of New Star Games, Simon Reed.
Yeah, Simon's a really accomplished programmer. Like, he started in Amos, like you said, and he kind of went into these text-based management games as well. And, you know, a lot of people love like Kevin Toms and some of these older ones. But he created one called World Cup Manager that was influenced by Dope Wars, which was a wicked game if you've ever played that one.
Yeah.
But then he started creating New Star Soccer, which was a really good series. That eventually went onto mobile phones. There was this kind of PC to mobile phone kind of path of development that he got into, and then he ended up creating New Star Games. With New Star Soccer, it hit 3 million downloads, huge success, and his most recent games have like got to the point on the App Store that they're actually being higher than Twitter or Facebook, you know, the actual app for that, which is absolutely insane. So they've been like massive successes. Retro Bowl was one of his most recent ones. And now we're going to be talking about Retro Goal as well. So Retro Bowl has some great mechanics and kind of dynamics in there. And, you know, it's just got that kind of retro feel, but addictiveness that even kids playing on modern platforms can look at it and go, oh, yeah, or have some familiarity with it.
Yeah, and even, you know, his latest game, like you mentioned then, Retro Goal, is a brand new retro-inspired football game that's available on mobile and on the Switch as well. Kind of definitely got that kind of early 90s look to it, hasn't it, that game?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Very accessible if you're a fan of like kickoff and sensible soccer. And we kind of talk a bit about, you know, how much he enjoyed playing those games back in the day and his early days. And he actually did a rip-off of Another World on the Amiga using Amos, didn't he, as a teenager?
Yeah.
So it's, which we've tracked down, which is quite funny to talk about. So really interesting guest this week, Simon Reed, the founder of New Star Games. He'll be coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. Before that, though, lots of news stories to update you on this week. And it is always nice when characters from the past make a comeback. And Joe and Mac, the cavemen ninjas, they are back.
Yeah, man, this looks really cool. So I've only ever played the Joe and Mac games a few times. And when I was younger, I used to think Joe and Mac and Caveman Ninja series were different games. It wasn't until I was older that I realized they were the same game. But yeah, this is released on all platforms earlier last week. So on November 24th, they all came out digitally, you know, Switch, PlayStation, Xbox. But what's really nice is they're getting physical releases as well on the 13th of December, so next week. But there's a bit of a strange history with this. So the game looks cool. It's got a bit of a new style cartoon look to it rather than pixel graphics.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's got the shader kind of look on it. It's more like, to me, it's something like Asterix and Obelix, that kind of cartoon style.
Yeah. It's got more of a cartoon style than like a retro look to it. But obviously it is a retro game. It's a, you know, a platformer beat 'em up, which is right up my street. But it's got an interesting history. So this has actually been in development for 13 years, this game
has.
It was actually announced in 2009. So it was actually started by Golgoth Studios, who they went bankrupt in 2017. And essentially, a company called Microids have published this game, and it's been developed by Mr. Nuts Studios, who picked this up, and the Toki remake that came out in 2018. They picked them up in 2017, have been essentially working on them since then.
So the graphic style looks very similar to that Toki remake. Actually.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So it's nice to see something that's kind of been in development hell for like 13 years finally kind of coming out. And, you know, it's an old IP, seeing some love as well. So I'll be checking it out, having a little bit of a game on that with my wife. I just, you know, I was looking at it, I was watching the trailer earlier on, and I was like, you know what? You know, you've got, what I was going to say, for Ragnarok, God of War Ragnarok, you know, came out the other week, and I was watching this and I was like, I'd rather be playing Joe and Mac.
I never knew about Joe and Mac because I wasn't a console guy. And how many games were there? Was it like quite a series?
Ravi, it did come out on the Amiga as well.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Well, it's probably one of the bad ports off a console.
I want to say there was...
Do you want to know, can I just tell you what score it got on the One Amiga magazine review?
Oh, yeah, go on then.
Scores up here. It got 22%.
Oh, there you go.
And Amiga Power gave it the same, actually, 22%.
Was there many Joe and Mac games? I think it might have been two. There was Joe and Mac... And then there was one where you played as like their kids, I think. And then there was a Joe and Mac 2. So maybe 2 or 3. There might have been a Joe and Mac Returns or something like that. I think there might have been 3 or 4. There's been a couple, but they're early 90s.
This version looks pretty 90s as well. You've got a T-Rex edition that comes with sticker sheets. I've not seen sticker sheets in games for so long.
Oh, wow.
Trading card and a keychain as well. But yeah, sticker sheets, that really brings it back. I remember getting
that does bring it back.
James Pond 2, and it had like all these James Pond sticker sticker sheets. It were quite good fun.
But it comes from that era, because, I mean, I remember playing Joe Mac at my friend Martin's on his Mega Drive.
Mm.
I didn't have it on the Amiga or anything back in the day, but it was that weird era, you know, around 92, 91, 92, when suddenly a lot of these kind of prehistoric games came out. You had stuff like BC Kid and Chuck Rock.
Yeah.
Came out around the same time, and Son of Chuck. You know, there was a brief era for about a year or two when suddenly loads of these kind of prehistoric caveman kind of games came out, weirdly. It was a bit of a trend for a while. But weirdly, because we were talking about this a while ago, because when you sent the story over, I was like, I'm sure we've mentioned this on the podcast before. And I've done a bit of digging, and they did announce this about 3 years ago, that this was going to be an exclusive game on the Intellivision Amico.
Ah, that's why it rings a bell. Okay.
Yeah, so, which obviously I imagine probably isn't going to happen now. Yeah, it looks like they're bringing it out on general consoles that people have actually got in their house and actually own instead.
I thought you were going to say we covered it because of, I know they did like a physical SNES cartridge release of it, you know, like recently on like HMV and Zavvi and stuff like that in the UK.
Yeah.
They've done a lot of these like re-releases of like Mega Man and a few of the Disney games, but on like an actual Mega Drive cartridge. But like, it'll be like, you know, transparent, colourful, so it's a repro. And they did do a Joe and Mac one of that. So I was like, maybe that's why it's ringing a bell. Maybe we covered that. But no, it was meant to be on the television.
So, yeah, I mean, again, it's always cool to see old franchises coming back. And if graphically it reminds me of that Toki reboot, and if any of the team were involved that made that, I mean, that was a really, really good update. Got that on the Switch, the nice collector's limited edition version of that, so that's really nice. So yeah, I haven't got hold of the Joe Mac reboot yet, but that could be one to play over the Christmas break. I think looks really good, so I'll put a link to that if you want to check it out, and the trailer as well in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did have our patrons hangout last weekend, and as always, it always seems to be a bit of a topic that we talk about, retro mobile phones. It seems to come up quite regularly on our patrons' hangouts. And Ravi found a really cool website that is a game jam of people making new games for the Nokia 3310.
Yeah, I'm going to go down the rabbit hole of like these dot matrix games and start getting a 3310 and modifying it for sure.
Because I didn't actually realize kind of how many games came out on not only the 3310, I mean, I had Snake on it, that was about it. But also there was other devices that were around that time as well, including the Palm Pilot. Now, that was kind of a PDA by US Robotics, came out in 1997, kind of a handheld PC, mainly designed a bit like an Apple Newton to help you write notes and keep track of events, and then you could synchronize them to your PC as well via a parallel cable from memory. But also it had some simple applications that you could put on there, including people made a bunch of games. Now, it turns out that there are now, you can play these online, 116 games that you can emulate that came out on the Palm Pilot.
That's pretty cool. Like, the Palm Pilot, I didn't really hear much about back in the days. It was one of these kind of names that I heard after the PDA craze. And I guess maybe that was because it was very American focused. And there was the Newton as well. There was like quite a few of these. I always remember having like the cheap Casio PDAs and you couldn't do much on those. But this is pretty cool. And it seems that, you know, archive.org are actually hosting it, who are always great at software preservation. But my friend actually has a Palm, but it's not the Pilot. It's like the later range of Palms. And he uses that because it's got GPS on it. So he actually uses that as his kind of navigation system. But it's massively out of date. So the amount of times I've been in the car and just got like completely lost, or it's like this road doesn't exist. But, you know, he's still into it and he still loves doing that. So Taz, if you're listening, update your GPS.
I mean, I kind of do love the look of these kind of, you know, the old monochrome games that are very simplistic. I mean, you're not going to be playing Grand Theft Auto on here. It's stuff like, you know, chess and checkers and Battleship and that kind of thing. But interestingly, there were quite a few games made for the Apple Newton as well.
Okay.
I did a video on my YouTube channel probably about 3 years ago, and I kind of went down that rabbit hole. I managed to find a working Apple Newton emulator that only works on PowerPC Macs. So I had to install it on Mac OS X Leopard on my PowerMac G5, but actually emulated the games quite well. And then I managed to kind of sideload them onto my actual Newton to play.
Oh, nice.
Which is quite cool with the connection kit. So it looks like, I mean, they're actually making these available from next week at the time of recording this. It looks like you will be able to download the original files and put them over onto your Palm Pilot, but also play them in the browser as well. And you will be pleased to know, Ravi, I've gone through the list, and one of the games that is featured in there will be Dope Wars for the Palm Pilot.
Oh, great. I thought you were going to say Strip Poker. I was like, I wonder how that would work. I see that Minesweeper...
You could play it on the Spectrum back in the day, you know, Samantha Fox's.
I think...
use your imagination.
Minesweeper's on there as well, and the idea of doing Minesweeper on the move is pretty dope.
Yeah, so if you have one of those PDAs back in the day, or maybe I'm sure some of our audience have still got them lurking in a drawer somewhere, it might be a good excuse to dig that out again. Hopefully they'll be on archive.org by the time the show comes out, and I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, we're going to tell you how you can turn your Nintendo Wii into an old-school Mac in just a minute, and something very cool that you can do with your Game Boy camera. Before that, though, now that we're into December, we mentioned that we just had our patrons hangout, but actually, there is going to be another one coming up a bit earlier this month, because Christmas is obviously the last Sunday of the month. That's when we normally do it. So we're bringing it forward a week, so that means December the 18th, Sunday evening, 8 p.m, will be the Retro Hour virtual Christmas party. And can I just say... NAF Christmas jumpers are compulsory this year.
Bring your NAF Christmas jumpers, your mince pies, your Baileys, your mulled wine. You know, come along, let's have a laugh. We did the one just, you know, Sunday just gone, and it was we were talking about some right bizarre stuff, but it was a real fun one. real fun one.
I'm going to go full Scrooge, so I have, like, you know, that hat with, like, that hangs down, and stripy pyjamas.
the thing is, we love doing this. This is when all of our patrons, we invite everybody on. It's just getting busier every month, isn't it? Which is just insane. I love doing this. And I always love the Christmas one as well. And I imagine because we're doing it just a couple of hours after the final game in the World Cup, people might be a little bit merry when they come on, which is always funny.
Oh, yeah, you've got to have a little tipple on the Christmas one for sure.
Got to be done. So that is coming up. If you want to join us for that on Sunday, the 18th of December, at the Retro Hour Christmas party. We'd love to see you on there. All our patrons are welcome. And actually, we're just dropping a brand new episode of our second podcast, the Retro Hour After Hours, this weekend as well, focusing on our top 5 arcade games. So all those memories of going to the seaside and, you know, those long summer days in the arcades back in the day. So if you want to check that out, and you'll unlock 30 previous episodes of the After Hours podcast as well for joining us on Patreon this weekend. All the details to support the show. And of course, the reason you're doing it is just to make sure that we can keep the podcast going into 2023. We can keep the lights on. We can pay all our hosting costs and everything. It all really helps us out with that. So if you'd like to join us on Patreon, all the details are at theretrohour.com. And we have got some new patrons to induct into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame!
And a huge thank you to our latest backers. Thank you so much to Grant,
Paul Harrington,
Frank Kuistra,
and Retro Jerry, who all backed us on Patreon over the last week. We massively appreciate your support, and if you'd like to do the same, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Right, this week's special guest talking new retro football games with that New Star Games founder, Simon Reed. He's coming up in just a couple of minutes' time. Before that, though, have you got a Game Boy camera looking anywhere in your collection, Joe?
I haven't actually got a Game Boy camera, no. And the reason I never got one was because I was always annoyed you couldn't record on it. You know, what's the point in having a camera if you can only take photos on it?
Well, I have got one. It's my wife's Game Boy camera.
Oh, wow.
She had one when she was a kid. She's got the a little bag that's got the Game Boy in there. It's got the printer.
Amazing.
It's got the camera, a little carry bag as well. But funnily enough, the bag that we carry all the dog stuff in when we take them out on a walk looks exactly the same.
Oh, really?
So I have actually picked up the wrong bag occasionally and took a Game Boy out for a walk before with a dog. but if you have got a Game Boy camera, it turns out you could probably film a YouTube video on it now thanks to this new solution.
Wow. I wouldn't record a YouTube video on it. So this comes from Game Boy Camera Extraordinaires, if you will. So this comes from a company called Inside Gadgets, who are big in the kind of like the Game Boy kind of modding community. And they've done a lot for the Game Boy community. They're actually a company who provide the boards for, like, you know, remaking like Game Boy boards and cartridges and stuff. So because of them, a lot of people have been able to make a lot of, like, you know, hacked Game Boy games and homebrew games and stuff, you know, which have been, you know, released through, like, you know, limited games and stuff like that, which is really cool.
Even the Game Boy camera modding scene. I mean, there's this article on Retro Dodo. People have been putting, like, DSLR lenses on the Game Boy camera.
It's pure lunacy. Insane. Like, I understand it's for a kind of novelty, you know, but there's no actual practical purpose
no
for this in any way. Like, you could take a picture and you could just, like, open up, you know, Photoshop and reduce it down to look exactly like it was made in a Game Boy.
Yeah, but that's cheating, Ravi. This is on hardware.
Yeah, where's the fun in that?
Where's the fun in that? But you are right, Ravi. You are 100% right. So this is the Game Boy Camera Pick and Record, which is now available. So it states you can record 1.5 hours at 3 frames per second. Use time-lapse option of 1 to 60 seconds or take 18,000 pictures. So my understanding is this is a mod board, a board essentially that you attach to the camera that essentially on the Game Boy camera, it has like, before you take the photo, it's got like a bit of a demo bit where you can kind of like wave at the camera and stuff like in it, you know, like a webcam essentially for, you know, it wasn't filming you, but you would see yourself moving on the camera and on the screen.
Yeah, the motion.
And essentially it utilizes that section of the hardware and it films it, doesn't it?
Well, it kind of bypasses it, yeah. So it's basically sitting between the Game Boy camera and the Game Boy and then outputting the video into another format, which is pretty mad. And also this kind of 1.5 hours at 3 frames per second, you may wonder like, what can I actually do with that? You know, 18,000 pictures, but stop frame animation.
Mm.
You know, you could create quite a cool like animated piece. And I think there might be a few Game Boy movies that start coming out of people doing like stop frame stuff. Yeah, it looks like a cool little device, and even like added as Dan said a higher-end lens on the top as well, which just makes it look about as high as the Game Boy itself, using the camera and the cartridge, and it looks a bit like a gun as well.
I do love this modding scene in the game, you know, in the Game Boy scene. It is really, really cool. So am I right in thinking, so it is a video, but it is essentially, it's just thousands of pictures.
It's like one of those webcams that you had in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, this is a live webcam, and then the image would refresh slowly. It's kind of like, that's how it's capturing it. And I guess there's a lot of limitations, you know, with the amount of data that's being sent through, that they're not going to be able to get, you know, 60 frames per second or anything. Like the limit here is probably the sensor on the Game Boy camera, I guess. And they can use lenses and they can use all other stuff to try and, you know, improve it, but you've still got that bottleneck of the actual camera itself.
That's the thing. I mean, if you, like Joe mentioned, there's that kind of selfie mode, which you can, well, I guess if you turn it around, you can on the Game Boy. When you see yourself on the screen, or you see the subject that you're pointing it at on the screen, and there's a lot of lag on there as well, and, you know, the image kind of takes a while to refresh. It's only 3 frames a second. Which is obviously going to be a limitation of the hardware. But I'm wondering now, you know, they always say that limitation breeds creativity. And with devices like this, do you think we're now going to see an FMV craze come to the Game Boy, that have FMV games now coming out on it?
I don't think they'll be able to do it. Maybe like the Game Boy Advance, they might be able to do that. But it's so 8-bit and limited. I don't know. But then saying that, we've seen people hook Game Boy cameras up and use them in Zoom conferences. Who knows, mate? Who knows?
Yeah, very cool though. Like we said, you know, there's no reason at all that you'd ever want to do this stuff apart from you can. So I'll put a link to that if you want to check out the images. Very cool. Now, this is really bizarre. The Nintendo Wii, a platform that never ceases to amaze me. Obviously, I mean, I remember when the Wii came out back in like, what, 2006, I think it was, wasn't it? I remember friends of mine desperate to get hold of a Wii. You remember Christmas that year, they were just impossible to get hold of. Turns out, you know, obviously, I think, is it still the biggest selling console, or is a PS2? They're definitely close, aren't they?
PS2's number one, the Wii's number two, yeah.
Yes, I know, you know, pretty much it's one of those systems that everyone's got one somewhere in the house. Even your grandparents have probably got one lurking under the TV or in a cupboard somewhere. Just the system that completely changed the world. And that era that, you know, really defined like the after party, didn't it? You know, you'd always end up going back to someone's house after a night out, or weekends around your relatives playing Wii bowling and Wii sports and that kind of thing. So the Nintendo Wii, and a great scene as well for modding, which is something that we talk about a lot on this show. It makes a really good emulation system. But I didn't think I'd ever see anyone running macOS on the Nintendo Wii.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This is running macOS 9, and Macs are PowerPC based, which is interesting. And I guess there's some part.
Well, they were then.
Yeah, I guess there's some part of kind of you know, that code base that's being translated here. But it's really interesting. They're so good to kind of mod. Having the SD card slot at the very front and being able to do, you know, a soft mod and getting into that homebrew menu is really easy. And there's a huge amount of stuff available for the Wii. I enjoy modding it myself. I've got a Wii U, but inside the Wii U is a virtual Wii as well. So I actually, you know, mod that as well. And it's a really cool little system. And it's one of the best emulation kind of devices out there. If you can get this huge array of emulators all set up and running well, it's pretty beautiful.
Now, this is a YouTuber called Dan Dumont, who's uploaded this video. Now, the video's in French, and the blog that he's uploaded as well in French, but we've kind of used Google Translate, and also there's a really good article breaking it down on Nintendo Life. Yeah, so what he's done is he's running macOS version 9.2, which came out around 2000, 2001. I think that was the last classic Mac version before it went on to macOS 10, which is kind of the foundation of macOS today. But yeah, he's got it running, and he's used basically a version of Linux that you can boot on the Nintendo Wii that then can emulate classic Mac software. So I do remember reading about this back in the day, Mac on Linux it's called. So people used to use this to run Mac applications on Linux back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And it turns out he's actually managed to get this booting up on the Nintendo Wii. Now, it does mean that he can boot up some old school applications on here, including Internet Explorer 5, that was the default browser on the Mac back in the day. Unfortunately, Wi-Fi doesn't work or anything on this emulator, so you can't actually get on the internet. He even shows iTunes loading up on here too. Another little disclaimer, there's no sound drivers, so you can't play any music. And you can even play a game of Doom running at a very unimpressive one frame a minute. So this is not usable by any stretch of the imagination. It is painfully slow, but it does prove that, yes, he can do it. He's actually managed to get macOS running on the Nintendo Wii, which I think is just an achievement in itself.
I guess it's because there's no, like, driver support or anything like that. It will probably be going like, oh, what's the graphics card? Oh, what's this? You know, it's pretty interesting. But, yeah, getting that running is pretty mad. And to be honest, like, Mac-wise, OS 9 is a world that I haven't been into. You know, I was OS X and all the kind of later ones. So, yeah, this is really interesting. If you want to fire it up and check what it's like with your Wiimote, then, yeah, you can experience Mac in a unique way.
Yeah, if Internet Explorer wasn't painful enough to use, you can now use it with a Wiimote on a Mac at about one frame a day. But yeah, I mean, it is very cool that you can do this kind of thing. And macOS 9 has still got a very loyal following. I mean, there are websites like macOS 9 Lives, which, you know, people are still doing new software for OS 9.
Oh, cool. I need to look into it more. Like, I'm sure that they're going to have an Apple II emulator on there. I don't even need to look it up at the moment. I bet you there's one already for the Wii. So they got the Mac, classic Mac covered, and now they're getting into the later range.
Yeah, so this looks quite complicated to do, but yeah, it is very cool. So if you want to check out that video, like I said, it's in French, but you can kind of see what's going on. I'll put that and everything else we talk about, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. You find them every week in your podcast app. Check the show notes, or you can head to our website for the links at theretrohour.com. Now we're going to be chatting to this week's special guest, Simon Reed from New Star Games, in just a moment. Before we do that, let's take a quick second to give a big thank you to this week's sponsor, and that is our incredible friends at AdBot. Now, Ravi and I both do this in our day jobs. I mean, you work on websites for people. Part of my day job is I work in marketing, so that means that, you know, I spend a lot of time in stuff like Google Ads. And I've got to say, anyone that uses stuff like Google Analytics or Google Ads and that kind of thing, Google, I think, is generally, their software is made by very clever programmers who don't always make it user-friendly. Yeah. I think in their mind, they look at the way the user interface works and it makes sense to a programmer, but for the end user, they can be a bit overcomplicated sometimes. I don't know if you find the same, Ravi.
Yeah, it can be overcomplicated. It's hard to work out, but also it's the most dominant platform in the world for advertising. And It's really, really quite efficient once you can effectively use it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they own 92% of the global search engine market. So if you've got a product, you've got a service, you've got a company, you need to be on there. And if you're doing advertising, this is a really good solution now. Google Ads can be really complicated if you're not working with an expensive agency. I mean, they've actually worked out that it can take you up to 20 hours a week to run your own Google Ads efficiently. And obviously paying an agency is very expensive, but that is where AdBot comes in. Now, AdBot is Google Ads done for you using artificial intelligence and machine learning. So that means they completely take over the day-to-day management of running your Google Ad campaigns. So really, it's like outsourcing your Google Ads to a bot that's going to keep learning as it goes on. And you know, you and I love bots.
Oh,
big
yeah.
fans of AI, aren't we?
Yeah, I've used bots for years. Like even our Discord channel is moderated by a bot. You know, they're kind of designed to make life easier. And with AI, you know, bots are going to get a lot better. And they work 24/7 as well, and 7 days a week. So, you know, your bot isn't going to go on a tea break. It's going to be doing a lot of work for you.
So with AdBot, I mean, you can automate your Google Ads in under 10 minutes, pretty much having your Google Ads on autopilot, and you spend less than 30 minutes a week ranking searches to help your bot learn. So they reckon they've worked out the maths here. This is going to save you, on average, around 75 hours a month. And it's so easy to use as well. I mean, honestly, you'd have to be an expert at Google Ads, digital marketing, or even advertising. Your grandma could use AdBot. It is that easy. 100% more effective than you doing it or someone doing it for you. And they're a trusted Google certified partner. So if you'd like to outsource your Google Ads to a bot and see what a big difference it can make, then why don't you try our exclusive offer just for listeners of the Retro Hour podcast. So if you head to this link right now, myadbot.com, and use our exclusive promo code, which is retro. So that is myadbot.com, and the promo code is retro, and you will get 3 months with no platform service fee. So that means all you pay for is the Google Ads that you will be paying for anyway, and you'll get AdBot for free for 3 months. So that applies to their $9 plan, and you can sign up for that right now. Check it out. Put your Google Ads on autopilot and make a big difference to your marketing. All of the details are on their website, myadbot.com. Use a promo code retro, and a big thanks to our friends at AdBot for their support of our show. Now, of course, with it being the final couple of weeks of the World Cup, if you're in a full-on football fever, you are going to enjoy this week's special guest. Going to be talking to New Star Games founder Simon Reed next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for this week's special guest. Now, obviously, everyone's been thinking about football with the World Cup recently, and we've actually been talking about some incredible new retro-style football games. So we thought we'd find out a little bit more with our guest this week, Simon Reed, who is the founder of New Star Games. Welcome to the show, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very good, thanks. Now, before we get into these amazing football games and other sports games that you've worked on so far, it's always nice to kind of go back to day one with our guests and kind of find out, you know, where their geek credentials started. So can you remember what, you know, initially got you interested in video games? And do you remember what kind of where it all began, your first experience?
I do, actually. It was my grandfather had a little video game device that he plugged into the TV. It was basically one of those kind of Pong, let's say, grey import devices. And it basically played Pong, and then like a version we had two bats on the screen, which was meant to be soccer. And it was very glitchy. I remember one of the controllers didn't work very well. It was wobbling around the screen. But that was my first introduction to video games, and I think I was probably hooked from then.
What was your first kind of home system like? I read that you had an Amstrad as well, so you were a bit of a... Amstrad fan.
But my first ever computer was a ZX81, which I bought secondhand. Well, my parents bought me secondhand. I was probably about 9 years old, I think. And that was a kind of glitchy system as well, where I don't know if you remember, you had to plug a tape cassette recorder into it. And if the settings weren't just right, things wouldn't load. I don't think I ever got a game to load on it. I just experimented with like programming BASIC and things on it. Yeah, so that didn't last long. I think the best machine I had in those days was a VIC-20, which was handed on from my cousin. I remember playing Football Manager on it and things like that. But yeah, the VIC-20 was a great machine that I love.
Did you have the RAM expansion on your ZX81 that crashed the machine if you breathed on it wrong?
Yes, I had that. It was so wobbly in the back. I didn't get much joy out of the ZX81. Honestly, it was. I can see why the person sold it on secondhand. It was, didn't hold much joy for me, I'm afraid.
Well, you mentioned the VIC-20, and obviously that had a really nice keyboard. I mean, pretty much same keyboard as the Commodore 64. So did you kind of get more into programming then? And what kind of got you interested in learning how to program?
Well, I mentioned Football Manager, and that was one game that really inspired me to write my own games. You know, I started learning BASIC straight away, I guess. And by the time I got my Amstrad, which was after the VIC-20, I spent hours and hours just in my bedroom coding, trying to make another Football Manager game. And back then we had, I don't know if you remember, the meter that you put a 50p in to keep the electricity going. Yeah. And occasionally the electricity would run out and I hadn't saved anything. She had to back it all up onto cassette. And I would be I'd probably scream for a bit. And my mum would be going, "Oh no, it's not happened again, has it?" I'd lose hours of work. But yeah, that was my inspiration, Football Manager, to create a football game.
So were you much of a footy fan then? Like who do you support, and were you constantly checking teletext as well?
Yeah, I was Spurs fan, which started when Spurs were in the FA Cup. I think it was 81. So I was about 5 years old, and I remember seeing Chaz and Dave on the Top of the Pops or something singing about Spurs, and I loved the song. I think it's Hot Shot Tottenham, something like that. And so for Christmas, somebody bought me some Spurs sweatbands, and that was it. I was a Spurs fan from that moment. They chose me, as they say.
Chaz and Dave influenced you. Yes. I love that. Yeah. I hear that you were a fan of like Match Day 2 as well. Why was that game so important?
That was probably the first game where me and my best mate at the time just started playing against each other, you know, two players. So he'd come round and I'd play it on the Amstrad, and then I'd go around his and play it on the ZX Spectrum. We'd compare them. But yeah, that's where it was a great rivalry. This rivalry went on from like, you know, early teens or sort of 11, 12 years old through to our 20s where we were playing on Xboxes or whatever. But yeah, that was one of the first games that we used to play against each other. Soon followed and surpassed by Eamon Hughes International Soccer, which was one of my all-time favourite football games.
You mentioned Kevin Tom's Football Manager. I mean, were you also really interested in that side of it as well? And I imagine the management aspect rather than just the game of football.
Yeah, well, the Football Manager basically inspired me because it was mostly text-based. And it's like, well, that's just kind of, you know, getting text up on the screen. You can do that in BASIC quite easily. So that's where it felt like that was an easy game to make, whereas opposed, you know, to Match Day 2 or something, which is all graphical. I had no idea what I was doing there. And it wasn't until programming languages such as Amos came along that allowed me to experiment with sprites and things. I'm not one of these guys that can show, you know, code in machine code or anything like that. It has to be very high level coding for me. I'm more of a designer, I guess, than a coder.
It's interesting because, like, back then I mentioned teletext and stuff. You know, text with football was... you know, you could get some excitement in there. You could actually get, you know, a kind of feeling of the game and the match where now, you know, you'd have to watch it or watch something, and even listening to the radio is a bit kind of like, you know, out of date compared to everybody watching it on satellite and stuff like that. Yeah. Did you like that kind of excitement and the language that was used in text games?
Yes. I mean, I'm not big into RPGs and, you know, those kind of text-based adventure games. And today I find, you know, like Japanese RPGs and things like that, which are very text-heavy, story-heavy, and loads of dialogue between the characters and things. It actually really turns me off. I'm like, oh, I can't be bothered with this. I want to get to the action. But with my games, I tend to use text quite a lot to just skip through the boring parts of the action, if you like. So where you've got defending to happen, it's like, nah, let's just put a couple of lines of text out. That'll solve that. Yeah. And so it's something that I do rely on, but try to use sparing. I don't like games that just throw too many words at you. It needs to be concise. And
I always find it like you'd have a text description of a match and you like read it in a newspaper and you think, oh, that sounds interesting. Then you watch the goal and you're like, oh, okay. It's not as kind of hyped as they said.
Well, you mentioned about Amos as well. That was a really good basic programming language for the Amiga. By the lovely Francois Lyonnais. We've had him on the podcast before. And obviously, I imagine you got hold of an Amiga by that stage then. I mean, did Amos help a lot then? And also having, you know, a 16-bit platform to develop games on. Kind of tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think Amos was the first time I could actually get some graphics up on the screen. We had an Amiga. Me and my football game buddy, Mike, we actually bought an Amiga between us. Well, actually, his mum bought it and we paid her off weekly, you know, with our pocket money or whatever. Nice. And we'd play obviously games on it a lot, but I'd picked up Amos to sort of further my understanding of coding and everything. And I remember writing a game very much inspired by Another World and, you know, that kind of spacey, kind of mysterious adventure game. And it probably took about 15 minutes to complete from start to end. But I think it might have appeared on a cover disc or something as like a shareware program. And I'd forgotten about this game, you know, until years later. And I see it popped up on YouTube and someone's actually played through the whole thing and recorded it on YouTube, which is just mind-blowing. I wrote it when I was about 15 years old. Yes, it's not very good. Homage to Another World, but it was my first proper finished product, I guess.
Was that the Captain Bonus in Another World game? I'm
looking
at
that's the one. Yes, yeah. And someone pointed out that on the title screen, Another World was had a spelling error, and I think looking back, that was because I was trying to avoid any lawsuits that just basically used the same name.
Yeah, WOLRD.
That was my very clever tactic when I was 15 years old.
Yeah, so it actually looks, I mean, I haven't played this, but I'm definitely going to give it a download and try it out. But I think graphically, it does look very much like Another World then. So, I mean, why did you kind of go down that path of trying to do an adventure-style game? Was that just kind of what you were into at the time?
Yeah, well, this buddy of mine, Mike, he did an art project at school, which was inspired by, do you remember Prince of Persia? Is it Jordan Mechner, the guy that made it? I think he filmed his brother doing loads of like karate moves and jumps and things. And he used those to sort of trace the sprites.
And rotoscoping it was, wasn't it?
Rotoscoping, that's it. And so my friend, he did something similar. He filmed himself running around doing jumps and all this kind of stuff. And then put the sort of frames into an art project. So, you know, it's more of like an animation kind of project. And I thought, well, I can use those. I can use those in the game just as, you know, it was done in another, Prince of Persia. So I got the sprite up and running and thought, well, let's do something along the lines of Another World and use that very much as a, it wasn't supposed to be, you know, it wasn't something I ever thought would get released properly or published, but it was just something I wanted to do and something that I actually finished, which was which is a very, very important thing to learn as a game designer. Just get a product finished and get it out there and just see what happens.
At what point did you move on from Amos then, and what language did you go into?
I remember doing my A levels. I did computer studies at A level, and I think I used Amos to do this A level project. You had to print out all the code and. It was like a database. And of course, I wanted to do some kind of football database. Everyone else was doing kind of, you know, business database management programs. And I thought, well, that's boring. I'm going to do something video game related. So I did a database of football teams and players, I think it was. And I wrote it in Amos and I was quite proud of it. And then my A-level results came in. I got an E. And I to this day, I think my tutor that marked that coursework just didn't understand the language of Amos and thought, well, I see it, I'm just failing, basically. I got an E for A-level computer science and gave up on my dreams of being a coder, I guess, a game designer. So I went to uni and studied English literature.
Well, a great text-based title that came on later was Dope Wars, and I absolutely love this title. I thought it was really innovative, and it really worked well on the web as well as on the computer. You worked on a title that was kind of influenced by that, which was a World Cup Manager.
Yes. Well, after my uni days, which I barely touched a PC for 4 years, it was. I remember the girl next in the room next to me had a word processor, so that's how we did all our essays and things. It was we borrowed that one and printed them out. Just towards the end of my university days, I remember doing a HTML course. It was like something you could just tag on to your studies, and it was my first time actually using the web and seeing how web pages are put together. And obviously it was very rudimentary back in those days, with hyperlinks and everything being this kind of newfangled technology. Yeah, so I that was my first kind of taste of PCs. But when I left uni, I came back home. Yeah, as you say, Dope Pause was sort of doing the rounds, and was this kind of sensational, slightly scandalous game where you had to buy and sell various substances to make money. And I thought, well, that looks really simple. That's just it's basically a Windows app with some buttons, which, you know, is using the text very cleverly again. It feels like a really interesting game. I thought I could do something similar, but for football, and make a World Cup Manager game. So yeah, that was my first sort of foray back into coding. So I was learning C++ back then.
And to be fair, that game could have been about anything, really. I think that kind of the mechanics of it were really interesting, and the kind of buying and trading and stuff. And you can see how that can apply to, football and players.
It's become, I mean, that whole kind of, I suppose it's like an early tycoon game, isn't it? Where you kind of level, as you earn more money, you can buy more things, and then you make more money from that, and you level up and buy more equipment. So I think in that you could buy a gun to defend yourself and things like this. But obviously when you start out, you've just got a few dollars to spend. And that whole ethos of leveling up and the RPG side of it is just massive now. I watch my boys playing, I've got three young boys, they all play Roblox. And so many of those games revolve around that tycoon aspect of starting with nothing and then, you know, building up a portfolio of items that help you earn more cash, and then you level up those items. It's just, you can see the seeds of it in games like Dope Pause.
Yeah, I think in many ways as well, that kind of gives you a good foundation in life, doesn't it? It's kind of a bit of a training for going into the business world later on, I guess.
Yeah, you do wonder. It's like their minds are completely tuned into this kind of idea that you just start with nothing and you can end up being a tycoon.
So what led to you forming your own company, Newstar, in 2003?
I think World Cup Manager came out. I put it on the internet, on a web page. People could download it for free. I think there was like a donate button. May have made a few tens of dollars or something, pounds. But I followed that up. Did I do that? I think I might have done the European Championships a couple of years later. And then I thought, well, you know, I need, if I'm going to start making money, I need to create a company. And, set up Newstar Games. It was just like a sole trader company, so any money that came in through selling these games would go into the company. Yeah, I think Newstar, I wrote the first Newstar software, which was very similar, all text-based, just buttons on a Windows app. And that started sort of getting a bit of a fan base. Again, not much money, only a few $100, but it was something that I sort of felt really passionate about. And I just kept upgrading it, you know, and making new versions. And with each one, the success would grow. And it was just really, really exciting.
Do you think there'd been a kind of gap of those like management and those kind of RPG style games in the kind of PC era, and having that coming out at that time led to this like fan base and following?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, the only game that I could remember that was in any way similar was on the Spectrum. It might have been on other machines, but I remember it on the Spectrum. My friend had it. It was Footballer of the Year, published by Gremlin. And I think that was, you know, all about scoring goals. You had like, I think you had like cards that you could, it was a bit like a board game in that sense, where you'd pick up a card and it'd have like, you'd earn some cash, or you get another shot for the next game, something like that. And it was all about being a player and winning the league. And that was something I don't think really anyone else was doing. There might have been the odd game here and there, but it was something I wanted to do. But go into it a lot deeper, you know, have proper divisions and pyramid system, and a bit more control over your life. So having, you know, a girlfriend, dealing with your teammates and your boss, that kind of thing.
That's really interesting, actually, having like the lifestyle of the players, because, you know, you play a lot of these games and it's like they're just these kind of sprites or these objects that you have that help, you know, you have the stats of their speed and stuff, but you don't have elements like their girlfriend and,
yeah,
you know, all these extras. Do you think that helped it kind of personalize the series?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone loves the casino, and I'm not sure. When did I put the horse racing? I think the horse racing was in New Star Soccer 3. And people would play it for, you know, for hours and not actually progress their career much. They're just like spending money in the casino or just enjoying the RPG elements to it. But yeah, I think that is quite unique. You don't get many football games where you can buy a racehorse and make money from it.
Well, New Star Soccer, I mean, did really well. I mean, the series hit 3 million downloads and we even got a BAFTA as well. So tell us a bit about getting that. And were you kind of blown away by the success in getting the BAFTA award?
Yeah, I mean, the game was my first attempt at doing something on mobile devices. And I just put it out there thinking, well, let's just see how it does. You know, I had quite a good following on PC, but the games were very different. They were a bit more broad, you know, you play the whole match running around on the field. Whereas the mobile version was really streamlined, where you just have chances to score goals, very much like Footballer of the Year. But yeah, it just grew and grew like that. I also put a web version out. So the web version helped, you know, increase the downloads it was only on iPhones at the time, initially. And, yeah, the downloads just started picking up day on day, and it was just incredible seeing it climb the charts. And then, you know, I was checking Twitter, and it was starting, the buzz seemed to be brewing on Twitter. And yeah, it was after about a month or two, I think it sort of went number one in the UK charts. So it was a huge success and completely unexpected. And it was probably about a year after launch that it won the BAFTA as well, which was just surreal, just absolutely surreal. They never dreamt of even entering it. So a friend of mine just said, you know, you should enter it to the BAFTAs. It'll win. It'll definitely win. And I was like, don't be dull. But it convinced me to enter it in. And it did win, which is just insane. And considering like EA Sports, you know, Codemasters, they had games in that year. So it was a real proud moment for me.
Did you have to get all them tuxedoed up and go to the awards and accept it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I had to do a speech as well, which was an acceptance speech, which showed I was quite confident because I'd written one out and memorized it. And I was presented the award by Martin O'Fire and a German tennis player. I forgot his name. Boris Becker.
Very cool. So, I mean, kind of looking to today, I mean, obviously New Star Soccer had a lot of fun elements in there as well and kind of in many ways felt that it didn't take itself too seriously. But do you think today that too many games kind of focus a bit more on realism and, you know, kind of lose that fun element with things like microtransactions and that kind of thing?
Yeah, obviously on a console there isn't a huge range of choice and it's all very much trying to look like Sky Sports. Yeah, TV presentation, which really bugs me. It's like, I don't want it to feel, I'd rather it felt like you were a fan in the crowd than you're watching it on TV with that kind of pizzazz and screen wipes shooting across and replays cutting in, all that kind of nonsense. So that's annoying. But yeah, on mobile, it's a better, yeah, more choices on mobile. But yeah, I think a lot of games, there's been a lot of New Star Soccer clones over the years, and none of them quite get it right. Most of them ruin it with microtransactions. And that's something I'm very sort of, you know, wary of. There are obviously things you can buy in my games, but I try to keep it fair and try not to nickel and dime players.
Well, you took the New Star Soccer series to like 5 games. How did the series like develop over time? And why did you move on to like Retro Bowl and Retro Soccer?
Well, the initial games on PC were just I just iterated on each version. I got to New Star Soccer 4, which I wrote whilst Lucy and I, she's now my wife, we traveled around Australia for a year. She was working as a nurse. Like, we spent 3 months in Sydney, 3 months in Melbourne, then 3 months sort of traveling. And I was writing it like whilst out there on my laptop, thinking it was going to be a huge success because New South Soccer 3 had been a big success. But actually, it came out and it was, to be honest, it was bug ridden and it didn't have the kind of instant appeal of New Star Soccer 3. So it was a complete letdown. And for a few years after that, I was kind of a bit disheartened by New Star Soccer. I kind of left it alone for a bit. I did some other sport games, trying to claw back some money that, you know, because we'd gone into a lot of debt traveling around Australia and not actually working, just working on a game that didn't make any money in the end. So it was just a case of like living day to day and trying to make games that would make a bit of cash. And it wasn't until sort of 2011, I think I did New Star Soccer 5 on the PC and Mac machines. And then that's what I use as a basis to translate it to mobile. So yeah, it was a kind of natural progression really. And I think those first 5 games taught me so much about how to make, you know, a game fun, and actually being forced to strip everything back and make a mobile game where you don't want, you know, complicated controls. You don't want it to be too deep. You want it to be quite instant so you can play it for 5 minutes. But the other side of that is I wanted to be able to play it for 5 minutes and have fun, but also play it for an hour and not get bored. So yeah, I think it was a real learning process from New Star Soccer for New Star Soccer 1 to 5, and it all culminated in the mobile version.
And I guess like mobile gaming's not as developed as it was, as it is now, but like working on the PC version and then porting it over to a mobile, what were the kind of considerations needed? And could you take much of the code and the assets and stuff and just transfer it across, or was it like a total rework?
Well, actually, I used lots of the assets from the art assets from New Star Soccer 5 and 4. What I was most proud of from New Star Soccer 4 was the kind of football database, like the competition database, where I had leagues from all over the world. I had all the cup competitions that go with those leagues. I had the European competitions and I had the international competition. It all kind of worked together in one as a whole. And I had to spend a bit of time porting that across to a new language called Monkey, which allowed you to write games for PC, but also mobile devices. Once that was in, it probably took a couple of months to get that translated. Once that was in, I could use the art from the earlier games and got the sort of mini game of kicking a ball up and running. And it was a very quick process from that point. It was about 6 months, I think, to getting the game out. And it didn't look amazing. It was obviously sort of cobbled together in lots of ways. But people didn't care about that. They just enjoyed the addictive gameplay.
You mentioned about the look of the game as well. I mean, do you think your players prefer the 2D style of gameplay?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I do. I've always loved that kind of sensible soccer viewpoint. Yeah, I think, I don't suppose it matters too much. As long as the game's fun and on mobile, it has to feel tactile. I think that's one thing I nailed with the ball bouncing across the screen and use your fingers to tap it. There was something similar to that on a web game. Where there are various versions of it where you'd take a free kick, they'd sort of set the angle of the shot, and then you'd click on the ball and the ball would swerve depending on where you clicked it. But I don't think anything had a bouncing ball and sort of tied it together in the same way as I did, where it was within the flow of a game kind of thing and you have different chances coming up. So yeah, I think as long as it feels right, I don't think it matters too much how it looks.
I was wondering, you know, you've got RPG elements in the game. Were there any other kind of elements that you'd like to add to the game? Maybe like a first-person shooter aspect at one point or something like that?
No, I do like that, having that depth on that side of the game. You know, it's something where you can have a career and it's not just about winning games and winning the league. It's actually a bit deeper than that. So if it made sense to you know, have any other mini games, I'd use them. But everything had to be sort of short and snappy and not detract too much from the sort of game loop.
Well, one of your games that's been massive in recent years is a Retro Bowl. Which, why the focus on American football for that then? Was this just to try and like reach a bigger audience stateside, was it?
It wasn't specifically that. I was a little bit of a lost, a loose end, I guess. I'd worked on New Star Manager, which relaunched on mobile, and it took a long time, and I was a bit kind of fatigued by the end of it. And I started just thinking I want to just do something simple again, something more akin to New Star Soccer. And yeah, I started out thinking about doing a kind of American high school game where you were just, you had a life to manage, where you had friends and family relationships and teachers. Part of that would be having these mini games, one of them being throwing an American football and to a teammate in the park. And then with the opportunity to maybe get selected for the high school team. And I just worked on that mini game, and it felt so good just throwing this ball and seeing your teammate run along and catch it. I started to develop it further and got, two teams of 11 on the field. And then I got them interacting. So when they hit each other, they tackle each other and things. It just felt awesome. Whereas the actual RPG side of it, of being a high school kid, was a little bit lame. So I thought, right, forget all that. Let's just make an NFL inspired football game. And I just put I remember putting the teams in the proper colors for two American football teams. I thought, it looks great. This is going to be great fun. And again, the development, once I'd been inspired and knew where I was going with it, the development was really quick. And I think again, within about 8 months, I'd gone from that to having a finished product. And it was something that I'd always been interested in, American football, but didn't really follow too closely. But I knew that Tecmo Bowl from like the NES days was huge success in the States. So I was very much inspired by that, but with my own kind of take on the management side. And it's not so much RPG, but it's definitely a bit more depth to the off-field stuff.
It must have kind of been crazy because that game was massively successful. Like, I think it hit number one on the store above like apps like TikTok and YouTube and stuff. And also TikTok really helped kind of, expose the game. What was it like when it kind of blew up like that?
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, you don't think, because New Star Soccer went to number one in the UK app charts, and you don't think that's going to happen again. That's a huge success for one man India, as it was. And it was interesting because I launched the game, getting the years now, but it was a good year before it had any success. I launched it around the Super Bowl time, and it got an instant kind of following because Apple featured it, and suddenly sales were good. I was really, really pleased. It was doing well, but it wasn't until the following. So it must have been a year and a half later that it sort of picked up again. I'd been working on it constantly, updating it, improving it, but it just seemed to kick off with the start of this season about a year ago and just kept climbing the charts. And it was around the time of Squid Game sort of craze, and there were a load of Squid Game clone things on the App Store, and they were all sort of sitting in front of Retro Bowl. Fortunately, Apple decided to take them down because they were infringing the Netflix copyrights or whatever it is. And suddenly I was there sitting at number one all on my own. So that was brilliant.
I mean, talking about that aesthetic, I mean, you mentioned the NES as well. I mean, why did you decide to go down the old school kind of pixel art look and make it look like an 8-bit game?
Well, one thing is it's easier. It's just so much easier to make, not too many animations. I could do some of it myself. We've obviously got an artist. John Savage does the Retro Bowl games. But I can tweak things. I can, I can just sort of hash things together myself. And if it needs to, then that's when I get a professional to actually help. But it's actually good fun trying to do it myself. And yes, it's nostalgic. That's the games I love growing up. So And I don't think, even my young boys play retro bowl and new style soccer, and they're not put off by the graphics. So it's not something that I think many people worry too much about, as long as it plays right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the aesthetic to me looks great, but that's really good to hear that younger fans, you know, it's not off-putting to them. But I think it just proves, doesn't it, that gameplay will always be the most important thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and but, I mean, Tecmo Bowl's a national treasure in the States. And I did worry that it might, that I was sort of treading on hallowed ground, if you like, you know, and people would just criticize it for trying to be Tecmo Bowl. But they're very different games. You know, this is a touchscreen-based game with management elements. There's not very much in that sense on the original NES games. But people love the fact that it looked like Tecmo Bowl, and people, some sort of casual fans confuse the two slightly when they're not sure which one they're referring to. But it's, yeah, it's something that I think does really surprise me. The love for the game from American fans is just insane. They've been so positive, and I get so few negative comments. It's incredible. Even if I got bugs in the game, you know, they're just willing to help out and try and test them, whatever. It's just a really good community.
I know you brought the game to the Switch, but in terms of mobile gaming, I find it quite interesting because in my mind, it's probably a very different kind of game that appeals to people on mobile. I mean, in one way, you know, it's a game that's always accessible and it's very personal because, you know, it's with you all the time. And it's a massive industry. But do you think in like the wider gaming world that the mobile kind of gaming industries, is it starting to be taken more seriously now, or do you think it's still disregarded a bit compared to, like, you know, PlayStation and Xbox games?
I guess it's still got a stigma about it. I mean, there are too many games which aren't much fun because they're just basically trying to get you to buy in-app purchases. But in terms of, you know, the revenues that some of these games make, it's incredible. They're, you know, the biggest successes on mobile are equally as popular, if not more than the biggest successes on console and PC. So yeah, I think it's absolutely a huge, there's huge opportunities for developers to have success on mobile, but it's getting very, very crowded because of those, you know, potential riches, I guess. But yeah, it's on an equal footing in my mind. It's, I think maybe because I've stumbled upon my preferred way of making games, you know, they don't have to be these AAA 3D titles. They can be simple and they can be interactive and just simple fun. And I guess that's where my strengths lie as a designer.
And you always get that kind of attitude that, you know, people are like Apple, they don't do that much gaming. And then you like forgetting all the iPhones or the iPads and, you know, thousands and millions of people that are using games on Apple.
Yeah, I mean, That's one thing. I mean, for all the criticism that Apple and Google might get, I'm never quick to criticize because they provided these platforms for me to get my games out there quite simply, you know, quite easily to get them out there. So, yeah, if the iPhone hadn't come along when it did, you know, at that point in my kind of game development career, then who knows what I'd be doing now, because I was very close to kind of having to get a proper job after going into debt, as I said earlier. So yeah, it came along at the right time for me, and it's just it's been a huge success.
It seems like fans have really taken to it. There's like stuff like leagues being created and like user created content. Do you really enjoy seeing that?
Yeah, I mean that's good. I mean anything that gets the community talking and you know, they've got websites and YouTube channels and things like that dedicated to the game. So it's just really, really rewarding to see. As I say, the feedback has always been positive. And I try to help in any way I can. So like one thing that these guys that run leagues need is all the stats from the season collated together at the end of the season so they can all compare their stats. So those sort of things I will put into the game just to make it easier for them. And, they've still got lots more requests and we'll see how they go. But, yeah, obviously the people, one of the biggest things right now is playing head-to-head online or even just passing the device between two players. But I'm just having a bit of a break from retro bowl updates for a little while.
Well, I was wondering, you know, the mechanics are really, really interesting as well. And I think that's what makes it so addictive and fun. Was there a lot of like testing with the mechanics? Did you try it out with your friends or have any kind of focus groups?
No, not really. No, I just I sort of trusted myself, I think. As I say, when I saw the players throwing and catching the ball and tackling, I thought, this just feels great. I kind of knew it was good. Never expected it to be, you know, a huge success, but I remember showing it to a few colleagues, and they liked it, they enjoyed it, but nobody predicted it would do as well as it did do. So,
well, Retro Goal was your next title, and how did you define that from Who Star Soccer and adding those elements from Retro Bowl?
Yeah, I think it was just time to go back to soccer, shall we say? Obviously the success of Retro Bowl, and this is an easy trap to fall into here, where I had success with New Star Soccer, so we thought, well, let's do New Star Cricket, let's do New Star Baseball. And those games never had anything like the success of New Star Soccer, and in similar instance here, it's like, well, Retro Bowl has been super successful, so let's try and do Retro Goal and try and recapture that success. And it hasn't been as successful, and I don't suppose anything else will be, but I still think it's a great game. It's had a great response from players. But yeah, it was a case of trying to capture what was good about Retro Bowl. Not so much New Star Soccer. There's very, very little influence there, I think, other than sort of the organic influence that happened through New Star Soccer and Retro Bowl, I guess. But it was just a case of let's do a football game. Let's do something 90s inspired with lovely graphics and, see if we can get another hit.
Was it important to go for that kind of budget as well and have it as a budget release to get more people kind of signed up to it?
On Switch, I guess, yeah. I mean, the issue is when you release a game for free on mobile and then you go onto console, there is a dilemma there of how much do you charge for it. But, you know, I think our philosophy there is if someone's not buying any in-app purchases, then realistically, what is it worth? And it's one of those where it's I like the fact that it's not expensive. I just want to get the fans to download and play it.
Also mentioning the Switch, it really kind of feels at home on there. What are the kind of great elements of working with the Switch, and why do you like it so much?
Well, I do love the Switch. It's just a great device. I bought so many games on it. It's ridiculous. And I do like all the old retro arcade games on there. It just feels great playing it with control sticks. We even got some of those NES controllers and made sure that, firstly with Retro Bowl, that it would work on that, just like Tecmo Bowl back in the day. And we wanted to do the same with Retro Goal. So it was just really nice to actually have a machine which is dedicated to game pad controls. And it did feel great seeing the players running about on a big screen. It looks awesome.
And I think the Switch kind of lends itself well to retro games, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean, there's so much on there. And I've been going through a bit of a shoot 'em up phase at the moment and just looking up old arcade shoot 'em ups. So I'm doing a bit of research, shall we say. That's what I tell the wife anyway.
Well, Retro Goal, at the time of recording this, it just landed today, didn't it? But so people can obviously go and download it now off the eShop.
Yes, yeah. And if you'd rather try it out for free, you can just download it on your phone or tablet and see what you think.
Definitely. Well, have you got any plans to explore any new kind of genres? I mean, you kind of mentioned, you know, cricket and that kind of thing. And is that anything you do in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we're always thinking about new sports, particularly. I don't know why it tends to be sport all the time, but yeah, I've got a hankering to do something a bit sci-fi, a bit spacey. That's why I've been sort of looking at shoot 'em ups recently. But that's just, you know, at the moment it's just thinking about it and wondering what the next project will be. So I don't know quite what the next one will be for me. As a team, we've got something very exciting lined up for early next year, which I won't mention just yet because it should be announced very soon. But that's going to be really fun.
Nice. Well, you have to let us know, Simon, when you're ready to announce it.
Definitely. Yeah, we shall.
Well, Retro Girl is available now on your phone or the Switch as well. Obviously, I'll put a link in the show notes. Really good talking to you, Simon. That journey, you know, from doing that the VIC-20 programming through Amos and now having these massive hit games, just an incredible tale. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories with us. It's nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.